Hello, and welcome to another edition of New Books in Systems and Cybernetics, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Tom Schult, from the University of British Columbia. Between his retirement from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign in 1975 and his death in 2002, many cyberneticians made the pilgrimage to Pescadero, California, to unravel the oft-elusive subtleties of second-order cybernetics with the master himself, Heinz von Förster. Fortunately, for all of those not blessed to have had an audience with the brilliant, playful, and generous man credited with founding the field itself, fellow Viennese colleagues Albert and Karl Mueller, no relation besides their mutual devotion to cybernetics as a whole, recorded their seven-day intellectual dance with von Förster, tailored it into an elegant structure loosely paralleling the Old Testament creation story, and brought it to the reading public as The Beginning of Heaven and Earth Has No Name, 7 Days with Second Order Cybernetics, originally published in German in 2002, and finally out an English translation from Fordham University Press in 2014. For those intrigued, yet occasionally stymied by the complex mathematics and at times eccentric and riddle-laden prose style of von Förster's academic papers, the book is nothing less than a revelation, as it clarifies and expands such essential Försterian notions as the eigenbehavior, the distinction between trivial and non-trivial machines, and a host of other insights regarding recursivity, genetic epistemology, and more, allowing the reader to return to the primary texts, ideally primed to fully absorb their profundity, inventiveness, and intellectual audacity. There could be no more eminently qualified curator of von Förster's thought than co-editor and University of Vienna historian Albert Mueller, who afforded me the privilege of discussing the book with him. So let's turn to my conversation with Albert Mueller. Albert Mueller, welcome to New Books in Systems and Cybernetics. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
You are warmly welcome.
Thank you. It's a great privilege to have you on the show, as you've made so many important contributions to the history and thinking about cybernetics over the years. So it's great to have you here. We're going to start with the traditional first question on the channel and on the entire New Books Network, which is, can you tell us a little bit about your academic background, your trajectory up to the present moment, and what led you to the deep engagement with cybernetics that you've had over the years?
I'm born in 1959, so I'm close to 60 now. I've been born in a smaller town of Austria in Linz. I went to the gymnasium with 18. I switched to the University of Graz and started studying history and German literature and language. This was at the time, it was a very conservative university, but you received your training as it was usual, and so I was looking around to something new or something else, and my first interest in combining the history approach with sociological things and sociological theories. And I started reading in these fields, and I had lectures and so on as a student. And my first focus was on medieval social history. And I did that and wrote my dissertation on such problems. And I continued reading new sociologically, theoretically interested books. And in 1984, Niklas Luhmann's German edition of Social Systems came out. And I was completely, astonished about how to do sociology in such a different way compared to Jürgen Habermas and to all the others I read until then. And I was fascinated by Luhmann, and in this book, Luhmann made a maximum use of people like Heinz von Förster, Humberto Maturana, and some others I never heard of until then. And as a well-trained historian, I started reading the sources. Yeah, I looked at everything I could find about Förster and so on, and Maturana and the whole thing, which was beyond my then focus and interests. And I learned a lot by just reading these things, and it was a completely new world for me. And it happened to be that I then met Karl Müller, another Viennese sociologist and philosopher, and he knew Hans von Förster already personally, and the idea emerged that we would celebrate his 85th birthday, Hans von Förster's 85th birthday here in Vienna in the house Ludwig Wittgenstein created for his sister. And this happened in 1996. It was a very interesting conference, having wonderful people there. And it was on constructivism and cognitive sciences and its historical roots and its current state. And this conference was the moment I met Hans von Förster as a person, in person, personally. And very soon the idea emerged that Karl and I would do an interview with Hans von Förster at his home in Pescadero. And the result of this week-long interview was the book, The Beginning of Heaven and Earth Has No Name, which appeared for the first time in 1997.
And so that's the story of how we got to this journey to Pescadero, which is in talking to others like Bruce Clark, you two are not the only ones to make the sort of pilgrimage to Pescadero to speak to Hans. Can you give us just a little overview of Hans von Förster himself for those people who don't know? And obviously, we're going to get much deeper into this. And what made him such a significant figure that the two of you felt this book project was something that needed to be done and that people would be interested in?
Well, Hans von Förster was born in 1911, before the beginning of the First World War, in Vienna, as son of a family of architects from his father's side and from a family of early feminists, artists from his mother's side. His aunt was a very famous dancer around 1910 and the following years. It was Käthe Wiesenthal, which I think is also famous in the US still, in the dancing scene. And he grew up in Vienna, went to the gymnasium, started studying electrical engineering at the Technical University here in Vienna, then went into the laboratory items industry. He somehow survived the Nazi period by hiding his in part Jewish ancestors. He worked for the German radar development business until 1945. In some dramatic years in 1945, Hans von Förster went to Austria, to the Alps, to hide from the effects of the final days of war, then had a few months later the chance to go back to Vienna and started two careers. One career in the IT business and another one as a science writer for the U.S. Radio station here in Vienna, Radio Rot-Weiß-Rot. That was the name of the radio station, and he did interviews. And after 3 years, he had also finished a little book of about 40 pages on memory and a quantum physical interpretation of the memory, which was completely new then. And he had the opportunity to go to the US as with a more or less a tourist visa then. And when he met some friends in the United States, he came by chance into contact with Warren McCulloch, one of the founding figures of cybernetics. And there was an immediate mutual understanding between these two persons. Hans von Förster was invited by Warren McCulloch to the sixth MACI conference, a series of conferences which were of real high significance for the development of cybernetics. And Warren McCulloch also helped to provide an academic job for Hans von Förster, and this happened to be in at the University of Illinois, Urbana. And Hans von Förster in 1949 started there as an electrical engineer first, and after a period of time where he also when he also worked as a as an editor of the MACI conference volumes, he was able to found the Biological Computer Lab in 1958 was the, it was a process of founding this lab, and this lab became one of the central places in the development of a new version of cybernetics, which and became also a place of transdisciplinary work, including people like Ross Ashby from England, Gordon Pask from England, Gotthard Günther, a philosopher from Germany who had to leave Germany during the Nazi period. Then Umberto Maturana from Chile, Francisco Varela for a period of time, and others, including Alfred Inselberg, who also had a regular position at the lab. And this lab was closed after a lot of successful years in 1974. And on the basis of empirical work in the context of cybernetics, Hans von Förster started to create a new theoretical framework. And this framework, which he contributed to, came up under the name of constructivism or radical. So after his retirement with 65, Hans von Förster went to California, built a house there at, in Pescadero, in close to Half Moon Bay, south of San Francisco, and he started a completely new and international career of publishing intensively, giving lectures worldwide, being a guest to conferences and to workshops all over the world. And at this point, I met Hans von Förster, and the idea of doing the book was to, since Hans von Förster didn't write books, he was an lecturer, an excellent lecturer, and he wrote excellent articles, and the books which came out under his name mainly were collections of his papers. And the idea was by talking about his work and career, to provide a kind of introduction into his way of thinking, into the history of how it came that he had his very, very special shape of thinking, of seeing the world, and of theorizing the world.
I have to say that this book is really such a tremendous aid to reading Heinz's papers in collections like Understanding. For those of you like myself whose math is not particularly strong, Heinz's papers are beautifully and beautifully elegantly written, but are incredibly challenging at the same time. And I find that this book really makes an incredible companion to working one's way through. And particularly because you, throughout the three of you, make references to very particular papers that one can go back and look at, like Epistemology of Living Things and Ethics and Second Order Cybernetics. And there's some particular papers that Heinz speaks at in some detail about, and that the two of you were able to question him about, that one can then cross-reference with the papers themselves, with what's in your volume, in an incredibly helpful way. You mentioned the Biological Computer Lab, and I do want to get into some more of the particular things you spoke about during the your interview with him. But I do want to sort of talk about the BCL just a little bit longer, because it is such an astonishing place. And you've also got another book, I know, the BCL, An Unfinished Revolution, about the incredible work that was going on there. And that is, like many things in cybernetics, not as known in the mainstream of science and history as it perhaps it should be. And Heinz talks a little bit about how focused they were on the wonderfully exciting work itself, that they didn't necessarily take the time to come up with what he calls a few important catchphrases or catchwords that would later catch on for other fields that were actually coming behind what he had been doing with second order cybernetics, things in chaos theory, etc., self-organization. But they had come up with names that had caught on. One of the main examples that gets talked about a lot is this idea of parallel computing, that they were developing ideas around parallel computing long before these things became popular. Can you say a little bit more about the BCL and perhaps the tension between really groundbreaking scientific work and the ability to publicize such work so that it becomes better known?
The idea of parallel computing, which was today is a technical standard, of course, and which became very popular at the beginning of the or at the middle of the 1970s. Yeah, it's trying to escape the limits of the so-called von Neumann architecture of computers. That means that you have to break down every task you have for your computer into a 0-1 operation, which goes then very fast, and you have to reconstruct results from this level to whatever you want to do, for instance, our talk now. And parallel computing was a technical idea, but in 15 years earlier, at the BCL, the idea to go beyond the von Neumann architecture also played a major role. One of Heinz's students then, Paul Weston, took over to experiment with such tools. And the idea was at the lab to build a machine which was able to count objects. You just imagine a kind of table which is attributed with light-sensitive cells, photocells, being connected in an analog way among each other, and then put objects, whatever kind, on it, and the machine should be able to produce an output saying these are 7 objects or 2 objects or whatever. And the idea of this machine, which had the nice name Numa Read from number on the bump as one first element and the retina as a second element, Numa read, it's just the border between an object and the non-object space that marks the distinction which enables the machine to count these objects. This sounds a little bit strange now, but this machine really worked, and it was a successful demonstration. There's a wonderful new book in German by a young historian of science named Jan Mückenburg, and I hope very much that this book will be translated and published in the US on this kind of objects created at the BCL. And the title of the book translated into English would be Lively Artifacts. Mückenburg shows very well that these objects, they did not make practical sense in a way that you can't do business with it or that are really technical things you can sell to IBM or such companies, but they were experimental things, as by the way also the British cyberneticians did in the 1950s and 60s, and these experimental things helped to reformulate own insights, growing insights into cognitive processes, and to help to look through how seeing, counting, hearing, looking at, recognizing things are be done by living organisms.
And in a paradigm that's very, very different from what we think of traditional AI, that staying closer to the original impetus of cybernetics versus what split off into AI, it's obviously a very, very different way of going about understanding cognition using machines. And I'm fascinated by this idea of being able to recognize number rather than count number. And I think there's the example of, you know, when we roll a dice, if it turns up a six, there's something that we could call the state of sixness that one can recognize that doesn't require us to count the individual dots, and that it's, in a sense, that's what this machine is sort of exploring, that ability to recognize the state of a number versus the kind of counting function of a number. Have I got that correct?
Yes, that was a point Heinz von Förster emphasized in this book. He talked about the N-ness that of things as an attribute of a situation. And in fact, it is, I mentioned the von Neumann architecture, and within the logic of the von Neumann architecture, it would take time to go from 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and the machines close to the ideas of the Numa read, they would immediately, without being without the necessity to count from 1 to 6, one after the other, recognize that there are six, at once recognize that there are six objects, for instance.
Which takes us much closer to, again, understanding genuine human cognition through the use of machines than what we see in much more digital kinds of AI.
Yes, of course. I think biological computing in the conception of Heinz von Förster and his colleagues then, it's much more closer to a kind of a gestalt approach, yeah? Mm-hmm. And which is normally left out by the AI people.
Right.
That's the one dimension. The other dimension is that while the AI people very early went into the field of digital programming, the BCL continued to work. The same is true for the English cyberneticians. The BCL continued to work with analog computing devices. Mm-hmm. Such Numerit is an analog device, in fact.
Now, Heinz famously said that the universe contains no information, that it is as it is. But in a sense, if we participate in the closure of some kind of operative unit, we reach a stable, what he called eigenvalues, which then emerge as information for us. But that this information was not, quote, in the game to begin with. It only emerged as these stabilities emerged. So can you tell us a little bit more about the eigenform? And Heinz tells this wonderful story in the book about first exploring this with a very early Hewlett-Packard calculator in about 1968. And this idea of the stabilities or operative units that are what he calls peeled out of the universe. And I think obviously the eigenform is a very central thing that you return to again and again throughout the book and is returned to again and again throughout Heinz's corpus. So can you say a little bit about the eigenform, the eigenvalue?
The eigenvalue is a mathematical idea going back to David Hilbert, a German mathematician who developed this idea, I think, in the 1910s and 1920s, and was an idea which was present in the field of mathematics, of course, Hilbert being one of the most famous figures in mathematics during the 20th century. And but I think the eigenvalue idea just until Heinz remained within the field of mathematics as a, well, genuine idea there. And Heinz took this idea and played with it and had developed a different approach. And the different approach he chose was in connection with the ideas Jean Piaget, a Swiss psychologist, had developed in the context of the growing up of children and the children's attitudes to the world. And there's the story that Heinz had been invited to celebrate the 80th birthday of Jean Piaget at a conference, and there he Heinz came up with a paper called Objects Token for Eigenbehavior. And so he took the term eigenvalue and transformed it into another term, eigenbehavior. The story goes on with other people like Lou Kaufman, who came up later with the term eigenform. Basic idea is that from certain algorithms being recursive, there's at some point stable from a kind of vibrating behavior comes up with a stable value. And so Heinz started to take this eigen metaphor to use it in a great variety of ways, but always having in his head this formal idea coming stemming from David Hilbert, who had developed these things decades before.
And in terms of even our basic cognition, again, the object that appears before us, because being a sort of pioneer of constructivism, as you mentioned, there's no ontological commitment to an objective description of an external reality, that the objects that we perceive are these kinds of stabilities that are the products of recursive operations of our sensory motor capacities. Is that, have I got that correct?
Yes. There's the closure of sensory and the sensorium and the motor side in living systems that was is a basic idea Hans dealt with since about, well, let's say the late 1950s, and it was also a task for other cyberneticians such as Umberto Maturana. There's this famous article at the end of the 1950s on what the frog's eye tells the frog's brain, and this is exactly this what is sensed and what is the motor answer to the sensory data.
And there's Heinz's notion of information. We already talked about the way that the analog computing was doing is sort of in contrast to the von Neumann architecture, but this, even his notion of information in contrast to the Shannon information, in that of Heinz's description of that there's the amount of information in a sentence is based upon the number of inferences that that the observer can make with that sentence. Can you say a little bit about that and the way his conceptions of information expand on and maybe revise some of the ideas in the Shannon information notion?
Claude Shannon wrote his famous article on his mathematical theory of communication. He didn't use the word information in the title, but in fact it's what we understand today as information, not as communication, which is much more a social act, mutual social act. When we talk about communication, Shannon was highly influential in the whole field, not only within cybernetics, but also within the emerging computer science, and we all know this in context with media technology and all this stuff. Shannon made a very interesting and quite simple operation. He defined information at something which could be delivered as a kind of package. And this package is transmitted from a sender side to a receiver side. And there's now a scenario of a channel which might be disturbed by effects of any kind, and he developed a mathematical framework, a framework of formulas calculating the loss of information during that path of transmission somehow. And the whole concept turned out to be highly efficient, of high technical use in many regards, but it is also clear that many things are lost when just relying upon this kind of modeling. And as I mentioned before, communication is a social thing, and the social dimension of information transmission is eliminated by Shannon's model. I think Hans and others' approaches are more, at this point I have to mention Gordon Pask, who worked years and years on what he called a conversation theory. And the conversation theory worked with individuals who could be persons and machines. And he was also in the business with learning and teaching machines. Pask tried to include the social dimension into what could be called communication again. And the same is true for Donald Mackay, for instance, another English cybernetician who did this in the 1950s. So to overcome the lacks of the ideas of Shannon, it was necessary to, well, rework the whole framework of what could be understood by terms of communication and cognition, of course, as well.
Thank you. You do a wonderful job. The book has got a great sense of playfulness that starts, of course, with the very playful nature of the way von Förster would speak and engage with people. And you playfully gesture to this idea of creating a Förster machine out of this these conversations that you have with him. And you identify a number of Förster operators. And we've mentioned a few of them. And of course, there's even first order Förster operators and second order Förster operators. We've talked about eigenforms. Are there other sort of Förster operators that you feel are particularly significant? I mean, they all are obviously, but ones that to really understand Heinz's thought, that there are others that we really need to try and grapple with.
Yeah, I think we talk a lot in this book about the concept of inversion. Yeah, it was one of the ideas of Heinz that immediately to take commonly shared view and to turn it around. Yeah, he played this game many times, and he used to read, for instance, the Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus by Ludwig Wittgenstein in this way. He just took out sentences formulated by Ludwig Wittgenstein and put it around. Yeah, he negated the Wittgenstein utterance. And well, this is a way which opens up, I think, a lot. It makes things visible you can't see if you don't do such a process. And this is not only a kind of intellectual play or intellectual game. It's also an act of enrichment. Of one's worldview.
And there's a couple that jump to mind from Wittgenstein, the idea that the picture is a model of reality, which he inverts into saying, no, reality comes from your picture, right? And the other one where they say, say it like it is, when they teach in journalism school, say it like it is. And Heinz insists, no, it is like you say it, right? And those from the constructivist angle,
These are famous examples of this kind of usage of such an modus operandi, turn things around, yeah? Just to have a look at what comes out if you do such a thing.
Right. There's also verb operators, this thing that you guys refer to in the book as verb operators. Something like science, rather than it being a noun, it becomes a verb. It's making knowledge. And this ties into also his love of the etymology of words and tracing their evolution over time to pick at what's maybe been lost in maybe what Gordon Pask might call the entailments of a word that have become kind of invisible. And this idea of – it seems to really chime with a lot of second-order cybernetics in Mary Catherine Bateson's book Our Own Metaphor. There's a section where they're talking about stamping out nouns because we need to understand things as processes rather than as objects. How important was that to Heinz's thinking?
It was absolutely important. Take the idea, but he shared this insight with a lot of other cyberneticians. just take the example of the term knowledge. Yeah, it's much more interesting if you switch from knowledge as a kind of package into knowing, which is an activity and a process and an unfinished thing, an ongoing thing.
Because those eigenforms can always change, yeah? They can always be transformed.
Eigenforms normally do not change.
Can they? But the idea that our picture of reality is what is fixed in our minds as a portrait of reality is open to change, though, is it not?
Cognizing, not cognition. Cognizing is an ongoing process, and you end up maybe with a certain Eigenform or Gestalt or whatever, something which is an abridgment of the cognizing process. But yes, this can change even permanently, I think.
We've taken kind of for granted the whole notion of the second order. As this conversation is coming to a close, we haven't really taken a moment to describe what to followers of second order cybernetics or people involved in second order cybernetics, perhaps is a better way to put it, understand as the second order. Can you say a little bit about second order operations as Heinz developed them, and along with, of course, as you mentioned, many other collaborators in the field of cybernetics?
That's. At the end of the BCL in 1974, Heinz set out his last project at the BCL itself, and it was a collective project he did together with other scientists and his students. And the result of this two terms lasting seminar was a volume called Cybernetics of Cybernetics. And on the first page of this book, which is a kind of compendium of first order cybernetics at the one hand, the classics, Norbert Wiener was included, of course, Ross Ashby and many others from the early years of cybernetics. And it was not only a compendium of first order cybernetics and the kind of thing you can give to a student or so, but it was also the starting point of what Heinz called second order cybernetics. And the first page he used to define these two terms, first order cybernetics and second order cybernetics, in a very short and, I think, precise way. And a very surprising way also. And the definition reads the following way. First order cybernetics, the cybernetics of observed systems. Second order cybernetics, the cybernetics of observing systems. So there's an ambiguity in this observing. It's the act of observing systems at the one hand, and it's the systems observing others and themselves on the other side. So I think this ambiguity is a key element in this definition, and the definition itself quite starting point of great influence on the further development of cybernetics as second order cybernetics.
Right. And he also, in the book, I remember him referring to it as the second order is the reflection on a reflection. And this interesting notion that second order operations send first order operations out on journeys and out on missions of a kind of reflection.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. You can, of course, play with this first order, second order. For a time, there was the idea that there is a third order, fourth order, fifth order, and nth order, a very closely connected to Russell and Whitehead's idea of meta levels, which allow a kind of infinite building upon. After some time, it turned out completely that there are only these two levels, first order and second order. You act in the way as observing yourself and objects or subjects or whatever on another side, or you just observe them as them. Yeah. And if you start to include yourself into your observing process or observation, you enter the second order.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much. There's so much more we could say. Of course, we've only scratched the surface of the amazing depths of Heinz's thinking and your own incredible wealth of knowledge in this field. But you've been most generous with your time already, so I want to be mindful of that. So we will close with our traditional last question, which is, what projects are keeping you busy at the moment?
I'm still in the history of cybernetics, and I'm currently working with the papers of the late British cybernetician Ranulf Glanville, who in his last will also had his papers sent to Vienna and to archival purposes here, and I'm just working with that at the moment, putting an order into it, cataloging them, and making it ready for research.
Well, I'm so glad to hear that, because as with the legacy of Heinz, I can imagine better hands for the legacy, amazing legacy of Ranulf Glanville to be in than yours, Albert. So that's good news for all of us. Thank you so much for your time, and I look forward to speaking to you again, either about a eventual book about Glanville or whatever is next for you. Thank you again so much, Albert.
Okay, it was a pleasure.